Hello, I'm your undercover operative, Martin Kessler, and you're listening to FlixBuzz Canada. Joining me today is returning guest Matthias van der Roost, if that is his real name. How are you?
I do have memories of playing the piano as a child. Or do I? I might be a replicant.
Well, thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
And today we're actually going to be discussing something related to Canadian film on FlixBuzz Canada, believe it or not. We're going to be discussing a pair of David Cronenberg films, neither of which are set in Canada, but it's History of Violence and Eastern Promises. So, Matthias, how were you introduced to these films?
I think it was through Viggo Mortensen, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, he was in the Lord of the Rings flicks, and I think that was a way in. And I'm not sure if I was as much of a fan of David Cronenberg at the time. I think, I mean, I remember buying, like, the DVD for Eastern Promises when I was in high school, because it came out when I was 15. Yeah, I definitely had seen the Lord of the Rings films at that point. But this was definitely something that looked cool, and you know, you have Viggo Mortensen looking like a badass on the DVD, and that was actually how I ended up getting into Cronenberg. And I think these are two of his more accessible films for sure. So, you know,
I think so, because they did seem to open up an audience to his films. Like I know people before had seen The Fly and stuff like that, but like a lot of his films, you know, maybe aren't that appealing to a wider audience. I guess some of them are. I can't say like completely, but
well, I
you
would
know,
say The Dead Zone and The Fly are definitely alongside, you know, History of Violence and Eastern Promises. Those are, I would say, his four most accessible films.
Right. Although these two seem like they were kind of a departure for him. Like it's for a lot of people that followed his horror sci-fi sort of stuff, it feels like this was kind of a hard break. It's not overnight. Like, I think if you look at Spider and films like Crash and Butterfly, he had kind of been easing into that for a while, but by the time you get to History of Violence, there's not really much that resembles films like Scanners or Videodrome Fly. Not really, you know, you can kind of pick through. I think we will talk a little bit about maybe some themes that do carry over, but you know, it's just sort of like a straightforward, or maybe not that straightforward, but it's a thriller.
Well, at that point, I would say The Dead Zone would be, I would say, because that has the least amount of gore out of these four, I would say.
Sure, but it's still weird. Like, there's telekinetic powers, and Christopher Walken's performance is very, like, off-kilter in that. And, you still have, like, hunting a serial killer and trying to kill a presidential candidate and all sorts of stuff that's maybe not as, you know, like it's based on a popular Stephen King book, so it's not like completely niche. Like, he's not really, you know, he was working in genre films, he wasn't quite like an art house guy, but some of his early stuff's like really out there. I don't know if you've ever seen like some of his early short films, like Stereo and Crimes of the Future.
No, those are just not, I refuse to acknowledge that they exist. They are not, you know. I do like, once you get into things like Rabbit and Shivers, and I mean, I do like those films, but those early, early films are so annoying. And they actually, when you see something like A Dangerous Method, I feel like it's almost like, I forget which one I saw, whether it was Stereo or Crimes of the Future, but I saw one where there was this big building. And they were just, they were walking around a lot, and it was very boring. And that's what I felt when I watched Dangerous Method. But to get back to History of Violence, actually, I do like the fact that in the commentary, he talks about it as if it is a creature feature kind of thing. He almost talks about it like he's talking about The Fly in terms of talking about the double identity that Viggo Mortensen's character has.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that I feel like links these two films most strongly. They come pretty close together. History of Violence is 2005, I think, and Eastern Promises is... usually it takes like 2 or 3 years in between his films, but these kind of felt like they came pretty close together and that they were connected by this dual identity
right.
character that Viggo Mortensen plays in both films. Like, we talked earlier that, you know, maybe A Dangerous Method could be included in the conversation because it's sort of a trilogy with Viggo Mortensen, but that one, it feels like he's playing a less significant character to right. the narrative of the story, and it doesn't really have that, like, it feels like it would be kind of the odd one out.
Yeah, I think
also,
so.
I find that movie boring. So.
Yes. I was hoping we could just skip that one because it's not even really worth talking about.
Right. No, I mean, his last couple films I found very frustrating, to say the least. Maps to the Stars. And right.
Well, but... there was something to that. And Cosmopolis even, I thought that one actually made me like... Robert Pattinson a little bit more. Like, I thought,
he's good at that. I like them both more than The Dangerous Method. I think, like, Cosmopolis, there's still one or two scenes, like the one with Robert Pattinson and Paul Giamatti, where I'm like really into it, that it kind of makes up for some of the stuff that I'm not as into.
Yes.
A couple of his, like, earlier films had sort of this weird pace, too. Like, have you seen Scanners?
Yes.
It's kind of like two or three great scenes with, like, a lot of filler in between. There's a lot of, like, sort of tedious stuff, and the main actor in that seems so uninvested.
Michael Ironside
is so interesting, but he's you know, kind of the bad guy and kind of the small character, but you immediately just gravitate towards him. So it's like, I feel like for me, Scanners, it's like a great, like, half hour short film starring Michael Ironside that's been, like, padded out by this other movie. But a lot of his films do have these sort of, like, thriller kind of elements, so, you know, in that way it makes sense that he would do something like A History of Violence and Eastern Promises, like, you know, even Naked Lunch, there's sort of this, like, thriller component that kind of feeds into the paranoia. So it's maybe not completely out of the blue for him to do something like these two, but it sort of feels that way for somebody who's getting into his films and likes Existence and Videodrome and all those kinds of films.
Yeah, I was talking about coming on here just to a colleague yesterday, and I was he was like, well, what are his other films like? And I said, well, and I kind of tried to explain what Videodrome is about. And you can just see people just looking at you like, really? So these films are really, you know, they're so much easier than, you know, anything else that he's done.
Sure. I mean, Videodrome, I heard part of the reason it is the way it is because they had tax break money coming in, and they just had to make the film by a certain date. So they didn't even have a finished script. They were, like, rewriting it as he went along and adding scenes and changing stuff. But it all kind of feeds into this weird, like, hyperlink kind of structure that it has, and it's sort of the unpredictability of it. Like, it actually works out, I think, to its advantage that it, I don't know, like, it's like plot almost feels like something like a growing tumor, you know, like it kind of matches up with the theme of the film.
Right. One of the things that kind of bothered me when I was watching it, I didn't realize that the doctor's name is it's O and then an apostrophe and then Blivion, right? So it's Dr. Oblivion, and I did not realize that until a lot later.
Well, it's funny, like, how much stuff in Videodrome kind of becomes even more relevant with the internet. Like,
yes.
You know, Oblivion is totally like a Twitter handle, right?
Yes.
Or a YouTube channel. I think you could actually remake Videodrome fairly successfully if you wanted to. Not that you should, but...
Right.
Anyway, back to Eastern Promises and Eastern Violence.
Right.
These films, they're pretty well scripted. I think I like the script for Eastern Promises a little bit more. The other one's written by Cronenberg. I think John Cripps mentioned the other day that he pointed out to me that Existence was the last film that I think Cronenberg actually wrote himself.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So, you know, it's been a little while. And that's the kind of last one that feels sort of like the old gooey Cronenberg. Right. After that, it kind of slides more into this sort of thing. But
well, that's one of the few that I haven't seen, actually. But isn't Existence, doesn't it have a similar sort of a gun thing like in Videodrome?
Yeah, it's kind of like Videodrome mixed with The Matrix, I guess. It's like, okay. Actually, it came out before The Matrix, but it's all about virtual reality and video games, and it's good. I think if you like the old school Cronenberg stuff, that's kind of in that pile, even though it comes a little bit later.
Okay.
I think, so the screenplays for Eastern Promises, that was written by Steve Knight, and History of Violence was based on a graphic novel, so he's already, you know, he's working with other writers, and I think they bring something structured to both of them that's kind of tweaked by Cronenberg. Like, he talks about adding certain things to the script of Eastern Promises, or maybe not himself necessarily, but I guess getting Steve Knight to explore certain ideas and add things and research, bringing about certain plot points, which I thought was kind of a good approach.
Right.
Like, I was surprised he said initially in Eastern Promises the tattoos weren't really a big deal in the first draft, I guess, or earlier draft that he read. Because they're such a big part of the final film.
Right.
Like, they factor into the plot and everything, yeah.
Well, they don't actually really get into the tattoos and what they mean actually all that much. I mean, there is that interrogation scene, but I have
with all the gangsters, when they can just, like, read his body.
Right,
and,
right.
Oh, this means something because you don't have that tattoo above your heart. And,
exactly.
Oh, you know, you're hoping for promotion because you have this, like, blank spot, you know, like, you kind of...
Right.
They don't really explain to you exactly what they mean, but you do get that impression that each one has a meaning and that it's like you can read a person.
Yeah, and one of the things that I do like is that, for example, he has three church towers, right, on his mm-hmm. on his back, which means that he's been in prison three different times. I'm just looking over the DVD cover because it has the explanations in there. Something like butterflies means that they are an expert in escapes. Or if you have a tattoo of Lenin or Stalin, that was actually done so that the guards in prisons did not dare actually shoot you. So if you got one on your chest, no one would shoot you because they would be shooting their own leader, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then some of them are actually kind of funny, where Viggo Mortensen said on his one foot, he had a tattoo that said, "Where are you going?" in Russian. And then on the other foot, it said, "Why do you care so much?" And so there are little in-jokes in the tattoos, actually. There's a certain sort of a dark humor to them, which they did talk about in sort of some of the extras, but they don't really get into that in the film as much.
Right. I mean, I should probably explain a little bit what the plot is. It's kind of like two main plots that meet up by the end, where you have, I think the opening scene is the murder in the barbershop, right?
Yes.
The Turkish mobsters killing a Russian mobster, and you sort of have this, like, retaliations going back and forth. They kill the Turkish kid, and then they have to basically pay for it by giving up
one of their own.
I think not only that, they figure it's going to be the mobster's son. They think it's going to be the Vincent Cassell character.
Right.
You know, he talks about, oh, the stars over my chest, they're like a birthmark. You know,
right.
It's his birthright, basically, that he's born into this mob royalty. So, like, there's this whole idea that he's a little bit, not jealous exactly, when Viggo Mortensen's character gets this promotion to getting these stars over his chest, you know,
right.
He sort of, at first he, like, congratulates him and hugs him, and then he's like, that was my idea, you know, and he tries to, like, and you still have a lot
true.
To learn from me. Obviously not true. And then, like, he's so out of the loop, because really the mobster, the only reason why he gives him those tattoos, that the mobster played by Armin Mueller-Stahl,
right.
who's, like, in Fassbender films and all that, it's so that he can kind of give him over to the Turkish gangsters to get killed.
Right.
Basically, you know, to equal things out. So you have that really great scene in the bathhouse. It's probably the most famous scene of the film, where,
right.
you know, they can identify him because of the tattoos. So they go in to kill him with the little carpet cutting knives. And he has to defend himself completely naked, which, you know, it's obviously hard to do. He's so vulnerable, but he manages to fight both of these guys. That's kind of the payoff with the tattoos. And once he has those tattoos, he can ascend through the, I guess, mobster hierarchy. And I think they allude to it before, but once he's in the hospital, they really make it clear that he's actually an undercover operative for the police. He's working with the police. So you have this idea that, you know, he looks like a bad guy in this film with the glasses and his hair back and he's covered in tattoos, but you find out that he's really a good guy underneath. And that's kind of the inverse of History of Violence, where he's like good family guy, and then you find out he's got this bad man hiding repressed underneath. So there's that aspect of it, and there's also the trafficked young woman who's pregnant, and she dies when she gives birth to this baby. And Naomi Watts' character is the one who has to kind of find out what her story is, and she's translating her journal, and that's kind of where the title of the film comes from. And it links back to these Russian mobsters who, like, at first they kind of allude to it being the Vincent Cassell character, and then you find out that it's his father in the film who's really the father of that child. So in the end, they arrest him for rape.
Right. I wonder how long has he been undercover? Because I would imagine
it must be like
years.
A long time. Yeah, or else like he was already in the mob and he converted like at some point. But I almost get the feeling like, just because we're pairing this with History mm-hmm. of Violence, like he's been this mob persona as long as Viggo Mortensen's been Stahl in History of Violence. Like, you know, it's long enough to have like two kids, and you know, it's maybe
right
18 years, 20 years, something like that. It seems like roughly the same amount of time to be this other persona. I like you have that scene in the hospital. Like, it's sort of a similar moment after he's been injured and he's revealing something about himself. They're kind of mirror scenes in both films.
Right.
So there's one in History of Violence when he's talking to his wife, and like she finds out that their last name his last name Stahl. She asks him, you know, where did that come from? And he just says, oh, it was available. And
right.
You don't really get an explanation. Like, you don't know if he found, maybe found a birth certificate for somebody who died when they were a baby and just, like, assumed that identity, like Day of the Jackal. Or if maybe there was somebody named Tom Stahl that he murdered and stole their identity. Like, you don't know exactly how he became this other person or what happened, but you can kind of start to just piece things together, because he used to be a character called Joey Cusack, right?
Right.
And, you know, he was a bad man, gangster. He messed up Ed Harris's eye and went on the run and just changed his identity and became this nice family man. And, like, you sort of feel like that character's worked so hard to change his identity, almost forgot himself that he used to be this other person. So in that film, History of Violence, like, what kind of kicks that off is you have these criminals murdering and stealing. One of them's Stephen McHattie. And they're basically traveling through small towns and, you know, robbing places, doing bad stuff. And they go into his Viggo Mortensen's diner, and he has to kill them in self-defense. And the media attention that gets put on him sort of brings these mobsters back from Philadelphia to find him. So, like, that's sort of the main plot of that one. I feel like, I don't know if you felt this, but, like, is History of Violence a little bit less tightly structured than Eastern Promises? Like, Eastern Promises, it sort of feels very, I don't know, like, everything in the plot kind of moves like clockwork. Like, there's not really room for coincidences. Like, you know, Naomi Watts' character works at the hospital, so that's why she has the baby. But that's also why she sees Viggo Mortensen when he's wheeled in, when he gets cut up after that. Like, it just feels like it comes together. Like, History of Violence, it's a little bit looser, so that, you know, there's a couple scenes which it's like, oh, this might not really serve a purpose in the plot, but it's kind of just to add to the themes or add to the flavor, like some of the stuff with the sun. Like, you know, it doesn't really feed back into the main plot. It's just sort of there to kind of ruminate on, you know, if there's, if he can pass on this like violent identity, or like it has a thematic significance, but it's not as, I guess it's not as plotty, a history of violence.
Yeah, it's not all part of the same storyline necessarily, but I do like, you know, seeing what the kid has to deal with. That I do like the bully Bobby, and how he keeps picking on this kid, and then when they want to beat him up, and then actually just when he wants to turn his car over, the two guys from the diner drive by, and they just give him this look.
Like they're real tough guys.
They will kill me. Like, these two, they're tough in high school, but they're, you know, they're nothing when they're dealing with real men.
And I think it's in the audio commentary, David Cronenberg talks about how, like, there's the scene with the son and the bully on opposing baseball teams.
Mm-hmm.
And originally the Suns baseball team's color was going to be blue, and the bully was going to be yellow. And he's like, last minute, he realized he should switch it. And like, yellow has these connotations, like cowardly. So he was like, no, no, we have to switch. So they rushed and switched everyone's costume at last minute to be able to film that. And like, Sun, I guess, realizing that like violence is sort of an option for him in like how they deal with stuff, you know, there's like that interaction between the son and Viggo Mortensen's character where he's like, oh, you know, we don't solve our problems by hitting people, and the son's just like, oh yeah, we shoot them, you know. It's sort of it's pretty cold. And then like, of course, the son's who rescues him when Ed Harris is about to shoot him,
right?
You know, so it's a little bit like he's going to pass this on to his son, maybe. And you know, what's sort of strange, like all the scenes where you sort of realize that it's like a stranger living in the home almost, you know, or there's this other identity coming out, the way he talks differently, the like Philadelphia accent starts like creeping back in at certain points.
Right.
It's, you know, like you have certain scenes at the beginning and then later in the film, which are meant to juxtapose each other. Like there's the early love scene between the wife, Maria Bello, and Viggo Mortensen, where it's like very cutesy. She dresses up like a cheerleader and it's very loving. And then like later on, you have the sex scene on the stairs where like after she has bruises and it's like very rough. And it's like, you know, you really do get the sense that it's this other person.
Right.
And like I think for me, the history of violence, it's not so much that like one persona wins out over the other, it's like they have to, he has to reconcile the two and kind of turn them both into his new identity, like a third identity, you know. It's almost like the fly going through the teleporter, like you sort of take the human and fly and fuse them into something new. So maybe there's some of that in there.
Well, that makes me wonder, like, which one of the two do you think ends on a more optimistic note? Because I feel both are pretty open-ended, like, things could go well, but is it likely? I'm not sure where these characters are at the end of the film.
I mean, they both end on very similar types of shots. You have the end of A History of Violence, where you have the family setting up the dinner table,
right?
And the daughter just kind of goes and puts his plate there, like, you're still welcome at this family. So like, it's kind of, it like, it gives me the feeling it's not going to be easy, but it's hopeful in the sense that like he still has a family, they still accept him, you know, whatever happens, they're going to kind of work through it all. And then Eastern Promises, in some ways, like, it's the happier ending, but it feels more pessimistic because like you have, you know, you have Naomi Watts with the kid, and then like the final shot is just Viggo Mortensen completely alone, and you sort of feel like even though he's done all the right things, like it's this totally isolating thing for him.
Okay, well, as far as Eastern Promises go, like I wonder, like you said, okay, he gives him stars just so he can pass him off as his son to a bunch of Chechens who don't know what his son looks like. But I feel like, why wouldn't they figure out who the son is first? And then also, he doesn't even like his son. You know what I mean? Like,
no.
And actually, the film kind of shows him as this guy who's emotionally unstable, shall we say. He's mostly just a drunk. And it's almost like, well, like, I wouldn't Viggo Mortensen do better, like, to keep him around rather than the son, or maybe send the son off to go live elsewhere or something.
How I take it is that for him, Viggo Mortensen's just disposable. He's just the driver. And even right. though the son, you know, he does see him as a disappointment, he's also his son, and, like, he's not going to turn his back on his own family. Like, I sort of take it that way. Like, it's just, like, in some ways, it's him being a little bit weaselly. Like, I'm going to give you this substitute. As far as identifying whoever, like, I just assume, you know, it's hard to see when you're doing a shady business with everyone. I don't know. And, like, as long as they have somebody dead with that rank, it's probably acceptable.
Okay. Yeah, so at that point, it doesn't even really matter who they kill, I guess.
I guess so. Like, I think it was just sort of like a straightforward deal. Like, he does have that talk face-to-face with the gangster with the mustache from the beginning, and it's kind of like, okay, you know, we're going to be square. We're going to just make this deal, and that'll be it.
Right.
You know, I have to give you someone, so I'm just going to promote this driver who, like, I don't really have any value in. And the Vincent Cassel character, like, it's sort of interesting. I know in the history of violence, Cronenberg mentions, I think in the audio commentary or one of the special features, that they sort of had this idea that the brother character, the Viggo Mortensen's character brother, they had this idea that maybe they should play him gay. And I think, like, that doesn't really translate to the film. Like, so I think, like, maybe it's just like one of those things they kind of thought up and it didn't end up on screen. But then it seems like they took some of that and incorporated it more into History of Violence, because there I definitely got the impression that the Vincent Cassel character is gay, right? Like, I think that's kind of, you know, you look at the scenes where they go to, like, the bordello,
right?
And he said, oh, like, I want you to have sex with this woman to prove to me that you're straight, to the Viggo Mortensen character. And the way he watches him, and then when he says, like, oh yeah, my father brought me here and did it himself, and, like, you kind of get the feeling that this father did the same thing to him to try to prove that he's straight. And then, you know, in the girl's journal, she talks about how Vincent Cassel's character couldn't have sex with her, so the father ended up doing it instead, you know. And then, like, you know, there's little allusions. Like, it doesn't come right and say it, but, you know, when the father asks Viggo Mortensen, like, oh, what rumors have you heard about my son?
Right.
It's enough that I think, like, it's definitely there on screen, and you kind of get the impression the son's, I don't want to say, like, a good guy, but, like, he's just sort of, because of his father, fallen into this bad life, and, you know, he doesn't really maybe have a bad heart. Like, at the end, when he's supposed to go and kill the baby, that's the, you know, evidence that could put the father away, you know, and he's just crying. Like, he doesn't really have the heart to be, like, this cold, ruthless gangster. He was just basically born into it.
Now, did you, I don't know about this, but I found out about this only yesterday, that the guy who plays Naomi Watts' uncle, Stepan, he's actually a Polish director, and I did not know, but I saw one of his movies, which is Deep End. Have you ever seen that one?
Oh, I haven't seen it. How is it?
Oh, it's very good. It's very good. I actually found out about that flick. It's like from 1970, if I'm not mistaken. But there's this German rock band called Can, C-A-N, and they have a song that's like 10 minutes long called Mother Sky, which is featured in that movie, and that's how I found out about it somehow. Okay. But that's actually a movie that he directed, which was kind of funny, and he's actually won the Golden Bear, which is the top prize at the Berlin Film Festival, for a film that he made in the 60s starring Jean-Pierre Léaud, who was in those 400 Blows and all those movies with Truffaut,
of course,
actually.
Yeah.
So that was kind of
cool. I did see that he was like a co-writer on Knife in the Water.
Right.
I don't think I've seen anything he's directed, though. I should probably check it out, because He does have quite a few credits, right?
Yeah, I think so. And that tattoo artist that tattoos Viggo Mortensen, he definitely looks like he's probably really, you know, used to tattooing Russian mobsters. I think he did have some sort of connection to that life. I wasn't able to find out much about that guy, but he looks shady.
I mean, for something like that, you probably could bring in a real tattoo artist. You don't necessarily need an actor, just somebody who looks like they know what they're doing with their job on screen. I mean, it's kind of funny. There aren't actually a lot of Russian people in the movie.
Right.
It's like a lot of actors doing accents and, you know, had to go and learn their Russian. I mean, Armin Mueller-Stahl, I forget if he's like East Prussian.
Yeah, he's from Prussia. Like, that's how old he is. He's from a country that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, East Prussia, which was like in Russia, present-day Russia.
Right.
And it was like German...
wasn't it in between Poland and German. Russia somewhere?
Yeah, like it was like area. Sort of... Yeah, right, exactly. right around Poland, Russia, and that got absorbed after the war and... Or during the war, I guess, probably.
Right.
But I don't know, like, maybe he might speak Russian...
Well, the Polish actor...
Just on his own?
Yeah, the Polish guy who I just mentioned, he spoke Russian, but it was with a Polish accent. And then everybody basically has a different accent, but they're speaking Russian. So it's this weird mixture of...
I mean, you do have people who speak Russian from all over. Not everyone sounds the same, but like there are some kind of wonky accents... in this, like, I, you know, nothing too glaring, but I think, like, I forget if somebody says, like, Dobronoc's weird, or, like, somebody says it definitely in a way where it's like, oh, that doesn't sound right. But Viggo Mortensen's accent's pretty spot on, I think. Like, it sounds good to me. I mean, you know, he definitely fits in well. I think he's a really good actor, so he...
Well, he acts in,
you know,
so
you can
many
tell he
languages.
Works on the accents and languages.
Right.
Yeah, like, have you seen Hoha?
What?
Hoha. It's maybe my favorite thing Viggo Mortensen's done. Like,
yes.
Where he's...
His
character's Danish, and then he goes to Argentina. And, like, I thought it was funny after, like, I saw some people were criticizing the film, being like, oh, like, his Spanish is really bad. But, like, Viggo Mortensen's fluent in Spanish. It's just, like, that character's Spanish is weird. You know, like, you hear him speak, like... you know, even in the translations, they make a point of it. Like when he's trying to explain that his daughter's disappeared, like invisible, like my daughter's become invisible because like he just doesn't know the words, you know. So like that, it's part of the story. It's not like Viggo Mortensen didn't learn Spanish,
right?
So
he's lived in so many places as well. I mean, he lived in Argentina, he lived in Denmark, I recently saw a movie where he was part of it. Was him speaking in Arabic. I mean, this guy is all over the place. It's pretty amazing.
Right, and it sounds good. Like, he's got a good ear for accents and languages. Like, he always pulls it off. And he has that quality where, like, he kind of seems like somebody who could be from just about anywhere or, you know, a lot of different places.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes you see him in films and he's... like such an all-American kind of a character. Like I just, you know, for Halloween, I was like watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre, one of the sequels that he shows up in, and he's like a Texan, you know, and then he's in Reflecting Skin where he's like very, you know, like again, all-American character, but there's something a little bit off. Like it could be from, you know, like there's something a little bit otherworldly about his presence, which like, I think, has been used well in certain films. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen The Prophecy with Christopher Walken.
Yes.
Okay. Like, I mean, that's going to be one of my favorite portrayals of a devil in a film.
Right.
Viggo Mortensen. Like, he has that just like sort of weirdness, like a little bit of weirdness to him that I think makes him fit into these kinds of roles. And it would make sense, you know, somebody from The Prophecy would show up in a David Cronenberg film or two. So.
Yeah, one more thing about The Prophecy, actually. The music from that, I've played that music for years. It's really good, actually. So, you know, if you haven't
I like
seen
that film,
it,
especially that first
out.
One.
What?
Seriously, like, it's... that first Prophecy film's really good. Like,
it kind of
turns into The Exorcist in its third act. But, like, aside from that, it's just, like, a really interesting mythology and kind of story, and I think the...
The main actor also a Cronenberg actor, Elias Codius from Crash.
Yeah, Elias... You see, there's a bunch of Cronenberg people that show up. Christopher Walken, mm-hmm. Dead Zone, of course.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody else we're missing, but like it kind of feels tangential to like those types of genre films that Cronenberg was making that are, you know, sort of weird and out there, but also smart and well thought out and have interesting character actors. Like, one thing I kind of like about The Prophecy is just, like, all the angels look weird. Like, you know, they don't look like how you would ever picture, like, when you go to the dollar store and see, like, little, like, hanging angel ornaments. Like, no, you cast, like, Christopher Walken as an angel and Viggo Mortensen. Eric Stoltz as an angel. Or my favorite is, like, just casting-wise, is the guy who dies early on and gets his, like... I forget the actor's name, but like the one they do the autopsy on, which first of all, like it's such a weird scene when they do the autopsy. I like any time a science fiction film has an autopsy scene of, you know, some creature that's not human. But it's just like they look strange and it's kind of unnerving and there are these violent characters. And I think it's the same writer who did Highlander. So it's also like this mythology of, I'm pretty sure I'm blanking on his name, but it's like, immortals going around in secret trying to murder each other present day, like that's kind of cool. Well,
they mentioned during the autopsy that he doesn't have genitals, which is kind of similar to the creatures from The Brood, like those little killers.
Yeah, like I don't know, it's sort of interesting to hear like what the taxonomy of something might be, you know, like I mean Eastern Provinces and History of Violence, it's like, oh yeah, there's still like a little bit of that genre film guy, like, you know, when they have to cut up the body that mm-hmm. he hides the message in to do his police report,
right. Yeah,
and like, you know, when they chop off the fingers, you know, like, well, he's still keeping those special effects people in business, and of course he gets the like scars on his face, like, oh, like makeup people still, you know, he's probably been working with the same makeup people for a long time, I guess, so it's like, oh, they still have work.
Or when the throat's being slit, exactly. I was gonna say the throat slitting, where you just see this deep, just gash, and everything is just like it's just coming out like crazy. It's so nasty.
All the violence in this is really like kind of upsetting. You know, I think that was part of David Cronenberg's point in talking about History of Violence. Is he said, well, like sometimes violence can be good, sometimes it can be bad, but it's always ugly,
right?
And he sort of tries to pull that, you know, kind of like Wild West romanticism of shooting people out of it. You know, the film's kind of like an anti-Western in that way.
Yeah, and like the pieces of once the sun kills Ed Harris, you see pieces of brain matter or his insides on the t-shirt and little things like that. It's just really gross, but, you know, I would imagine that's what it looks like.
I like Ed Harris's makeup where he's got the like dead eye, and like that's also again like, you know, kind of back to the old Videodrome type stuff, just like, you know, the creepy makeup on the face. Right. But I think he mentions he tried to like murder him with barbed wire, right?
Right.
That's the backstory there, and like eesh. But I like Ed Harris so much as a villain in History of Violence that I feel like the film loses a bit of steam once he dies. Like the third act, they sort of introduce William Hurt as the brother character, which like introducing characters kind of in the last minute, it's hard to have that same kind of emotional buildup as like Ed Harris, who's been kind of taunting him this whole time and hanging around in town, and they clearly have a history. Like I think like maybe for that reason the third act feels a little bit weaker in A History of Violence.
Well, it's only really the last 15 to 20 minutes. I mean, he's only in the movie for something like 10 minutes, and somehow he got an Oscar nomination out of it.
Yeah, I think it should have gone to like Ed Harris, if anyone, for a supporting actor. Really. So, William Hurt, I think he's a good actor, and I think he's actually kind of an underrated actor, but I don't find he has that strong of a presence in this film.
Yeah,
even though they do build him up as the brother.
Well, up to that point, you know basically nothing about him other than his name. It's a very short appearance. And, I mean, he lives in this giant house and he's complaining about, you know, oh, you cost me so much money. And And it you know, he's still complaining about something that happened probably about 20 years ago and saying right. that he didn't get promoted because of it. But you would think that if he was such a great gangster that he would have been promoted anyways. Like, it's been a long yeah. time. Like, if you're that good at it, like, I would imagine you're running your own thing.
I mean, there is that thing, like, you know, I have a brother, and I do know how, like, stuff from 20 years ago can just, like, come up in a conversation.
Right.
It's like, oh, like, I can't believe you stole that toy or some right, stupid right, right. thing like that. You know, like, sometimes those do just stick in your memory. But I do like his delivery right before Viggo Mortensen shoots him, where he's mm-hmm. like, Jesus, Joey. Like,
right.
it's such a kind of drawn-out delivery. Or, you know, when right. the Viggo Mortensen gets away and he's like, how can you mess that up?
Oh, yeah.
Like, when the...
Yeah.
gangster gets killed with yeah, you know what, like, it's maybe it's that, like, I have a hard time kind of just buying William Hurt and Viggo Mortensen as brothers. That could be part of it too.
Well, they, like, look nothing like each other, so
no, they really do not. Like, the closest thing you get is they both have, like, pretty distinct chins. Like, they kind of have the bum chin, but other than that, they really don't.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's sort of a weird bit of casting. Like, I almost wish that the payoff would have been, like, you know, if Ed Harris didn't die in that shootout and, like, he has to go back to Philly to kill him. Or, like, something like that,
right.
maybe. Like, Eastern Promises, I find that it works a little bit better kind of building up to the Armin Mueller-Stahl character getting busted. You never actually see him get arrested. I think
right.
it happens, like, off-screen, you know, which... Like, I'm kind of okay with...
Well, I think it hasn't happened yet by the end of the film. They've taken his
right.
blood, but they haven't arrested him yet. Probably they will sometime soon, but I don't think it's happened yet.
I guess I just assumed, like, he'd be arrested because he's not in that last scene where Viggo Mortensen's, like, in
right.
this big place all by himself. Before he had seen, it was, like, full of people. Like, there's the...
Mm-hmm.
I forget if it's a birthday party or Christmas party, but,
yeah.
like, you know, there's... Big dining
Christmas.
Table full of all these people. Yeah, you know, they're singing songs, and, like, at the end, it's just, like, completely quiet in there. So,
right.
You know, you get that juxtaposition. But, like, Mueller-Stahl character kind of feeds into this idea of people not being what they seem, because at first he seems like this very genial, friendly kind of guy. Oh, I'll help you translate, and he's playing the violin for these little girls.
Right.
And, you know, it seems, like, very likable. And then, like, as things go on, you find out, oh, he's a monster.
Right.
So... It's this idea that comes up in both films that you can think that you know who somebody is or what they're like, and then on the inside they're a completely different person.
Right. Well, actually, the whole violin thing, he apparently, when he was a kid, was very good at, and he was some sort of a concert violinist.
Right.
So that's kind of cool.
That's cool. I mean, one of my pet peeves in movies is... what an actor clearly can't play the violin, and, like,
right.
the fingering doesn't match up to the music that's playing, and it's just like somebody
right.
slapped on a soundtrack, and you go, like, ugh, like, it doesn't match up at all. But,
well,
no, he looks like he
violin,
knows what he's
right?
doing. Yeah. So that's a plus, that he looks like he knows what he's doing there. Maybe we should mention some of the other performances. We didn't talk about Naomi Watts that much, and she's
no.
really great.
I do like her, yes.
She also had kind of, like, a genre film background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, like, one of the first things I saw her in was Tank Girl.
Oh, isn't Ice-T in that?
He sure is.
As,
he plays a kangaroo man.
Right. I've
yeah.
only heard of this thing, but it sounds insane.
It's like a comic book film that really just feels like a comic book, but with the budget slashed to almost nothing. Like, it's really bonkers, but it's so much fun. I like it a lot.
I gotta see it sometime, man.
For sure. It's really energetic and colorful and fun, but she plays Jet Girl in Tank Girl. You know, and I think she's in, like, one of the Children of the Corn sequels and, like,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Like, you know, or even after she kind of got famous, she's still showing up in The Ring, and she
right.
still does these genre films kind of from time to time, but... like, I think what was kind of her big breakout was Mulholland Drive, right?
Right. Yeah.
Of course, the stuff she does with Lynch is great. I don't know if you've
yeah.
seen the
she was great
Twin
in
Peaks
the
Return.
Exactly. She was great in that. That was, oh, Dougie! And,
Dougie.
Yeah.
Janie E!
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, that's a really great character because, like, when it starts off, you think she's just, like, like the cliche kind of housewife, and then as it goes on, like, you know, you realize, oh, she's tough, and she she can do all, like, I like there's one scene where she has to stand up to gangsters who want their like loan back, and she's like, no, you're not getting anything extra, like, this is it, that's all you're gonna get, and she talks him down, and I thought a little bit of Eastern Promises when I saw that, but she's really good at kind of like going down that line between like the chipper sort of almost like 1950s like classic Hollywood style acting like you see in some of Mulholland Drive, and then doing stuff that's a little bit grittier, and I don't know, she's great. And like Eastern Promises, because there's like a lot of these tough guys and mean looking guys, it's nice to have somebody who kind of anchors the film to some sort of emotional sensitivity with the baby, with like sort of bringing out the Viggo Mortensen character's gentler side, you know, like I like when they're just bonding over the motorcycle,
right?
Which again, like, I know David Cronenberg is a big motorcycle fan and car enthusiast, so like if you stop and look, like, a lot of motorcycles pop up in his films.
I never noticed that, although of course in what was it, Rabbit, where there's a lot of motorcycles, and of course you have Crash, but wasn't it Rabbit where the young vampire chick is, I think
there's a motorcycle crash at the beginning, right? Like, that's how you get the operation.
So. Yes.
Where she gets the, like, tooth in her armpit. But, yeah and he directed this film. People don't normally see it because it doesn't fit in with the rest of his filmography, but it's called Fast Company, and it's just, like, a car racing movie. And, like, nobody else has seen this, I feel like.
I've heard of it.
I mean, I'm sure some people have, but, like, I go to... I don't know if it was just, like, exclusive to Canada, but there was this, like, big Cronenberg DVD box set, and it had Fast Company and as one of the movies, and it's pretty... The thing that feels, like, very David Cronenberg-y is just, like, all the car crashes, which, of course, comes back in Crash.
Right. Is so it any good, though?
No.
Okay.
No, it's just, like, sort of interesting to see if you're, like, oh, okay, like, that's kind of where you get stuff, like, Crash, and like, you know, he clearly has something for cars and smashing them. But I even thought it was funny, like, the fly, the telepods, the way they were designed, it was like based on a part from the motorcycle. It just, if you look at the motorcycle in Eastern Promises, you get a good shot at one part, it's like, oh, that's the telepod, it's just like a piece of the motorbike. So I don't, you know, he's always interested in just, like, fusing people with people and people with machines and our relationships with technology, you know, like, that's kind of an aspect that comes up in his genre films, and, you know, it's not really present here, but you just do get, like, shades of it when they're fixing the bike and bonding over it, and then, like, later it's the motorcycle that she uses with him on the back to go and rescue the baby at the end, so...
Right.
It's, like, little hints and leftovers and shades of his other films just kind of popping up here, but I don't know, like, how do you feel these films sort of fit into his filmography?
Well, I mean, I think we've talked about that a bit. I think they're the more accessible ones, like, if you and I think they're the ones that, apart from maybe The Fly, that these are the three films that people may actually have heard of or have seen, I think.
I guess. I mean, I heard him talk before. He said, like, you can make a film that's incredibly interesting to, like, seven people. But, of course, nobody's going to see that. So you do have to sort of broaden out your appeal sometimes, you know.
Right.
Not dumb yourself down necessarily, but, like, you do have to, I guess, try to find a way to get your ideas out there.
Well, sometimes,
in a way that people will actually come and watch,
Yeah, sometimes you have to make the packaging look appealing so you can sneak something in there, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah.
And here it's always, like, an issue what has to have Canadian content. And, I mean, it's so bad, like, it even made it onto our Netflix, so now we have a stupid Trailer Park Boys on our Netflixes. It's like a certain percentage has to be Canadian. But, like, it's always up for debate what...
Yeah.
What counts as Canadian, you know, you have people making fun of it, like on SCTV, the Bob and Doug McKenzie, just this joke at the idea of what is Canadian content.
Right. But what would be some movies where you can definitely tell, like, oh, this is where they're not trying to dress it up as America, but, like, are there movies where it's like, yeah, this is a Canadian movie, deal with it? Like, what are some of the more famous ones?
There are, and I hate them. I had to watch a bunch of these for, like, Canadian cinema class. Like, have you heard of a film called Mon Oncle Antoine?
Not sure.
It's, like, Quebecois film. For a long time, it was, like, the Canadian film. It was always, like, top of the polls, like, top of the lists, critics' lists. And it's, like, so Quebecois about this, like, boy so going to live French. With this uncle. Yeah. And then it's only sort of recently the director was exposed to, well, like, he's dead, but it kind of came out that he was a child molester.
Now
it's off all the lists. Probably won't see that any. But it was, like, released through Criterion. It was, you know, big deal. But
wow,
there's plenty of, like, snowy Canadian dramas, which are very explicit about, like, yes, we're set in Toronto. And, you know, it's sort of funny when, like, somebody comes from outside of Canada to make a film that's set in Canada, like Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, that takes place in Canada. I forgot about that. Yeah,
it's like super there's the record store where I buy those DVDs, and that doesn't exist anymore, but it's like, oh, like, I know where that is, and I know where that is, and that's before they changed the fare for the TTC, you know. But I remember when Edgar Wright came, he was like, oh, you know, we were briefly considering shooting in New York and making it look like Toronto, just as a joke, because so many films are shot in Toronto and made to look like New York.
Right. I think that's so odd that that these cities look that much alike that they can get away with that.
I think they don't really. Like, they're, sometimes you can notice it's, like, really obvious. Mm-hmm. Or, like, a lot of the times it's just generic American city that's more often than a specific place. It's like, oh, that could be some, you know, one of the big cities. I love the Resident Evil films, and it's always, like, fun seeing, like, oh, like, that's the pizza on my street, when you're watching through them, and you can pick out sometimes some of the buildings. Like, I know Denise Cronenberg, David Cronenberg's sister, did the costumes for like, when you see Mila Jovovich jumping dressed like she's got this ninja bodysuit sort of thing that's Denise Cronenberg. So, like, it's a real Canadian production. I think as of now, the highest grossing Canadian film is still, like, technically Resident Evil Retribution or something like that. It was, like, trivia when they had, like, a Canadian Film Day. But, I mean, like, I think a lot of the films I like that are Canadian, they sort of maybe capture, like, a different side of Canada that I'm not used to, because it's... You know, the stuff you're used to is not always what you find interesting. Like, on the past, we've talked on the show about Antanasiwa, the Fast Runner, which is a Canadian film, but that's sort of about life in the Arctic before Europeans arrive. And, like, that feels just like a world away from the stuff you usually see.
Well, speaking of which, Nanook of the North, wasn't that filmed in Canada as well?
It might have been shot in, like, northern Quebec, I think.
Right.
I think we actually talked about it on the Antanasiwat episode. But what's sort of interesting about Antanasiwat is it's all in an Inuit language, and it's directed by Inuit filmmakers, and it's just sort of based on oral tradition. Like, it's not like, you know, an outsider coming in and trying to capture the culture. It's like a product of the culture itself, which I don't know. Like, I think it, like, adds a lot of authenticity to it. And it's sort of like, I mean, I don't know what's up with Canadian films and, like, naked action scenes, but there's a scene in Antanasiwat where I think, like, he marries one woman and it works out well, and then he decides to marry a second woman, and she sort of causes trouble for them. So, like, her brothers come to try to murder him in their tent while he's sleeping, and he manages to escape, but he's completely naked, and he's running across the Arctic all naked in the snow, and his feet are bleeding, and he's just, like, running for his life from these guys with spears. And it's really exciting if you ever get a chance to see. But
sounds great.
So Canadian films and naked action scenes, that's a motif, I guess.
Right. Well, how do you feel about I know that at one point they floated the idea of a Eastern Promises sequel. Now, it never happened, but how did you how do you feel about that?
You know what? I was definitely interested. Probably, like, the chances of Cronenberg ever seriously doing it were always kind of low, because like, he just doesn't really strike me as much of a sequel guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, The Fly was such a big hit, and, like, that was such his maggot baby of a movie, but, you know, even he didn't come back for the sequel, right?
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. Although, like, I've seen him do talks here a couple of times, and I know at one of them he did talk, I think, while he was in pre-production on it, sort of seriously. Like, he was talking about how easy research is now that you have internet. He said, you know, normally he would have had to have gone over to Russia and really investigate. He was talking about, like, I think the hot springs and bathhouses, like, way out in Siberia, and just describing that. And he said, like, he learned so much of that just from Google, basically. Right. That was his research process. But I think there was a script, and, like, they were kind of looking into pre-production and getting Viggo Mortensen to come back and all that, and it just never really got off the ground, which, like, you would think commercially that would be sort of a quick and easy yes, and I think, like, artistically you probably could do a good story, but I think he ended up doing Dangerous Method and Cosmopolis instead, right. Sort of moved on to other things. I know the screenwriter, Steve Knight, he's directed a couple of things recently, right? Like, he did Locke with Tom Hardy.
Oh, really?
I think, and I don't know if he's directed, actually, or if he's just, like, written some of the episodes of Taboo and stuff like that. But
I did like Taboo. I saw that recently, actually, that show.
I still need to watch it, but I like pretty much everything Tom Hardy does.
Right.
And, like, Stephen Knight's a good screenwriter. You know, after Locke, like, I think maybe if he wants to, like, he should go and direct the sequel himself with Viggo Mortensen.
Right.
I don't know, maybe if there's a role for Tom Hardy, bring Tom Hardy along.
Right.
You know, because presumably, from what Cronenberg said, the whole thing was supposed to be set in Russia, I think. Present-day Russia. It would be like Viggo Mortensen going back to Russia for some reason, and it would be like some new story, some new adventure.
That does sound great. Now, have you seen, there was actually a TV show, which is kind of similar to Eastern Promises, which was called MacMafia, which was a BBC show about this Russian guy who was an exile. Like, he mm-hmm. had to leave Russia or he would be killed. And so he's this older guy who's a bit of a drunk, and he has this son who is kind of brought into the underworld. He's this banker, and one of the main roles was actually David Strathern. But that was actually kind of the same idea as Eastern Promises, and that was actually a pretty cool show.
Did it come out after Eastern Promises did?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I think it only came out like 2 years ago or something.
Okay, because, like, there was this big boom in interest in Russian mafia. Like, I feel like it wasn't really, like, people didn't really know about it, and then Eastern Promises came out, and then, like, it felt like I was seeing it everywhere. Right. Like, I know it was in one of the Grand Theft Auto games was all based around, like, Russian mafia, and the guy I saw, like, on the cover had tattoos, like, Viggo Mortensen on his hands, you know? So, like, it seemed like all of a sudden it was in a lot of movies and TV shows. It generated interest in it, and especially this whole, like, idea of the subculture with the tattoos.
Right. Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting is they did mention how these Russian gangsters never use guns so that they can kind of get around easier, where they can just say, oh, no, you know, we just need this knife for work purposes, which I thought was actually kind of smart.
Right. I mean, I sort of took it as, like, that's just how Britain is, where you can't really get a hold of guns, like, the very strict gun laws, like, you basically can't.
Well, if you can smuggle, like, women, I would imagine you can smuggle guns if you really wanted to.
I guess so, but it would probably draw a lot of attention to you if you ever had to use it. Like, I know the uncle character who's talking, mm-hmm. he's kind of, like, nasty guy. Like, I don't think he's actually KGB, but he sort of pretends he is, and
right
or, like, pretends he used to be, and like, when he's talking, like, oh, I've got a connection, like, I can get a gun from someone,
right?
It's sort of this, like, shady,
this really thing, old, like, gun,
right? But I know, like, David Cronenberg talked about the knives they use. He said, like, they're carpet cutting knives. So the idea was, you know, like, within the reality of the film, like, oh, if those criminals were ever, like, stopped by police and they said, oh, what are you doing with these knives, they could say, well, we're carpet cutters, that's our job. Like, you could sort of explain it away, those, like, short slashing knives that they use.
Right.
You know, like, even the knives themselves aren't that big. It sort of ends up being not that one-sided when they come after him in the bathhouse.
Right.
Compared to the History of Violence, which is, like, all-American and it's, like, full of shooting.
Right.
So, like, I almost took that as, like, just, like, a little bit, not a comment necessarily, but just sort of reflective of, you know, setting a film in America versus setting a film in UK. Like, it's just, like, a different idea of how criminals have to operate within the rules of the society, even right. though they're criminals.
Right.
We'll definitely do another one before too long, but thank you. And where can folks find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter daily. It's at Matt R. Says. That's in one. There's no spaces in there. And it's two T's, actually. So there you go.
Cool. And if folks want to follow the show, it's at flixwiz.com, at Movie Kessler on Twitter. And I think that's all you need to know. Go find me, follow me, do whatever you want to do, or don't. It's up to you.
And until next time, listeners. And leave a review. Oh. That always helps podcasts get discovered, right?
Yeah, I saw Ali, who was on the Whitnell and I podcast, left a review, so that was really nice of him. Thank you. Thanking you on air. I already thanked you in person, but thank you. So, yeah, until next time, listeners. Take care.